Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is former Republican Senator Olympia Snowe. Senator Snowe, who represented the northeastern state of Maine for 18 years, is now a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, that's a think tank based here in Washington. She is the co-chair of its Commission on Political Reform, and we're coming to you from her office in downtown Washington. She is also the author of Fighting for Common Ground, How Can We Fix the Stalemate in Congress? Weary of the political gridlock and partisan rancor, which continues to exacerbate the political divide in the United States, Senator Snowe decided to retire from the Senate in 2012. She had previously served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 16 years. The Commission on Political Reform, which she co-chairs, just released a comprehensive report entitled Governing in a Polarized America, a Bipartisan Blueprint to Strengthen Our Democracy. We'll talk with Senator Snowe about some of the causes of the polarized state of politics in the United States, which has not only undermined many Americans' faith in their government, but also has brought the country to the brink of paralysis. Remember the partial government shutdown in 2013? And note the record low public approval rating for the Congress, now hovering below 10%. We'll talk with Senator Snowe about her commission's recommendations to reverse these trends, which erode confidence in America at home and abroad. Senator Snowe, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's great to be here.
Thanks for hosting us here in your office. Well, Senator Snowe, as a way of broaching the report and its recommendations, remind us why, after 18 distinguished years in the Senate, and one could argue many more promising years ahead in public service, you decided to retire from that body.
Well, it was a difficult decision and one that even surprised myself because obviously I hadn't been contemplating it. I had been preparing to run for re-election for a fourth term in 2012 and had been working 2 years organizationally and financially to be prepared for it. You know, it started to occur to me about the political dynamic in the United States Senate. And the questions that people posed to me as I traveled the country raising money for my reelection, they would ask me two questions. Is it going to change in terms of the gridlock and the partisanship in Washington? And how is it going to change? And I started to ponder those two questions and came to the realization that, in fact, it wouldn't change in the short term. So I realized that I should take the fight for bipartisanship on the outside of the institution because the change would not occur from within. And I decided this point in my career, after having been in the U.S. House and the United States Senate for 34 years in Washington, that I could best contribute by fighting for that change on the outside and empowering people and making sure I could convey how they could change it and they shouldn't settle for anything less.
Well, before we go into how you can change things from the outside as you're doing right now, talk a bit about how you think we came to this point. What are the factors that led to the polarization and lack of comity which characterized the country and the government?
It's interesting because we always had sharp differences and fierce debates over time, especially on critical questions. So there were a number of contentious moments, you know, in my career and looking back on some of the major issues of our time in the 1980s and 1990s and even the first decade of the 21st century. But we always understood that there would be a way forward to reconcile those differences. What changed dramatically was the notion that somehow our differences were irreconcilable, that people refused to work across the political aisle. And as time passed, more people were facing a political penalty at home in primaries, for example, and even in the general election if they worked on a bipartisan basis, depending on the makeup of their state or their congressional district. So that all dramatically changed. There was less incentive to work across the aisle because there was no reward for it. In fact, it was a penalty invited to primary challenge. So ultimately what evolved was more focused now on who's going to be casting those ballots in the primary, who will be their competitor, as opposed to the broader population and broader views on particular issues. And so that evolved, and especially in the last few years, And then suddenly, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, the issues became more intractable. And basically, it became a legislative lockdown where people weren't willing to work across the aisle.
Indeed. Well, you're well known as a centrist Republican, someone willing to work across the aisle. And as you said, it seems to be a dying breed, and we'll get into more reasons about that. But you have written and spoken about your frustrations with the U.S. political system, both during your time in office and, of course, since you've retired. What do you think are the top two or three things that have to happen to reduce polarized politics and get lawmakers from both parties to want to work together more than they are right now?
I think some changes within the institution and some outside of the institution in the campaigns. For example, I think what's going to be critically important is redistricting commissions to be established that are independent, have the support of the two political parties, but are more impartial and fairer than the way they draw lines now for the congressional seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. Today, most of those 435 seats are non-competitive seats because they're either in the hands of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, because the way the lines have been drawn to exclude any potential competition for that particular candidate that represents a party. And so the legislatures have done that so often, it has been the case, and that has been a marked difference and departure, particularly since the last census, but it's been evolving, where there are very few competitive seats remaining out of the 435. Some say as few as 7 toss-ups, 21 or 68 seats. So I think that has to change, have states adopt these fairer process through these independent commissions to draw the lines so they become more competitive seats. And also bolstering the turnout in these primaries. There's a very narrow fragment of the population that's casting their ballots in these primaries for political parties. 2010, in those primaries, the average was 18.7%. The last 20 years for midterm primaries for congressional seats, the average has been about 20%. So very few people turn out. And one way to bolster that is to allow for open primaries so that people who aren't affiliated with either party, independents, could cast their ballots in those primaries. So it would generate more interest, greater participation.
So right now, in a Republican or Democratic primary, only those who are Republicans or Democrats can vote.
That's correct.
And so what you're saying, open it up to independents. What about Democrats voting in Republican primaries or vice versa?
And there's that option, too. There are various options, and obviously the states would decide which option is preferable. But I guess you could either have semi-open or open primaries. Today, many states have closed primaries. In those 4 or 5 states that have open primaries, they're seeing many more competitive seats than the national average. So it does have that net effect. When you have more open primaries, more people participating. We're also calling for a single primary day for congressional elections. Now, we have that in our presidential primary, which we call Super Tuesday, where many of the primaries occur on that day. That generates a lot more national interest, public interest, enthusiasm, and focus on that particular day. And we think that that would benefit these elections with greater participation if we had one single day for these congressional primaries that would be in the month of June.
So these are more electoral reforms, but the commission report also talked about some congressional reforms and something called call to service. What about recommendations under those categories?
On the congressional reforms, which are significant, is obviously how the Congress conducts its business. And unfortunately today, and regrettably, even since my departure from the United States Senate, it's grown worse. There's very few legislative solutions that are being produced by Congress, very few issues that are ever debated, consistent with the traditions and practices of the United States Senate, where you'd have amendments and you have long debates and trying to bridge both sides. Very few amendments offered on the floor in which senators have the opportunity to vote. In fact, since last July, there's somewhere between 10 and 15 amendments has been the total number of amendments upon which the minority has had the opportunity to vote. But even on the other side, on the Democratic side, many senators have expressed frustrations because they have been unable for years to offer an amendment and to get a roll call vote on their particular issue. So I think that that suggests the degree to which the process has been degraded in the Senate, which is the deliberative body. That's where you build consensus, and that's not happening. So we think filibuster reform becomes incredibly important. Today, in the United States Senate, you can have unlimited debate on issues, and unlimited until you get the 60 votes to curtail that debate. What we're saying is a filibuster motion would not be allowed on the ability to bring up a piece of legislation, but it could be allowed on the bill itself once they're debating the bill or on the amendments that are offered. But at the same time, guarantee a minimum number of amendments that have to be offered on the floor of the Senate that could be offered alternatively between Democrats and Republicans so that there is some semblance of a legislative process where the minority as well as the majority have a chance to explore some of the issues. If amendment process doesn't take place in the Senate, you can't, you don't have that deliberation, you don't have the consideration, and you basically get much more of a parliamentary system where it's an up or down vote and then they take it to the next election rather than trying to work through the issues, which is much more in line with the original design of the United States Senate.
And of course, this call to service, what about under that particular category, getting more Americans involved, because people are getting so disenchanted and therefore they don't have the incentive to either run for office or work in public service?
Well, that's certainly what I've noticed and detected in my trips across America. When I've talked to so many students on many college campuses who feel frustrated, disillusioned, disenchanted with the political system, they want to contribute in the world around them. They want to be part of some form or realm of public service, but they certainly aren't interested in running for political office because of what the system has become, politics of destruction. It doesn't seem positive. They don't know how they could even possibly make a difference in the kind of system that has evolved today. And that's unfortunate, and we have to revive and restore the interest in public services. I tell them they have to get involved, and especially if you want to change the tenor in the way in which elections are occurring today. So we are asking young Americans to contribute a year of service. And it can be of all types of service. It doesn't have to be running for office, but for nonprofits or in your community and so forth. And many of the positions for AmeriCorps, Teach for America, have been very important. And unfortunately, the demand has been so great. Many thousands more would love to be able to participate. But unfortunately, those slots haven't been funded by the federal government. So we're asking for public-private, partnerships, the private sector for communities to help support those initiatives as well so that we can encourage young people to volunteer and to take part in their communities and the world around them that will nurture the desire to continue to contribute some way throughout their lives.
Senator Snow, I want to go back to your recommendation with respect to redistricting, having independent or neutral commissions. We know that this is the responsibility of the state, of course, here in this country. It's very decentralized, very federal. How much of a challenge do you think this will be? Because this is the purview now of the state, and I assume states would have to agree to change this system. How big of a challenge do you think that will be?
Well, I implored the audiences that I've addressed to become involved in this process. I always say I wish I could go out and gather signatures for some of these petition drives to establish redistricting commissions. It could be done by legislatures and governors, that's for sure. But if there is not that ability or willingness to adopt independent redistricting commissions, then citizens could determine what the rules and the laws are in their particular states to initiate a petition drive to get it on a ballot. What are the rules and laws regarding citizens' referenda, for example? And so we're asking them to go to our website, bipartisanpolicy.org, one, to learn about our recommendations, two, what they can do about it with respect to petition drives or approaching their elected officials in their states and their governors, and to build public pressure. Because what it's all about is the public has to become engaged and involved to put the kind of pressure and the demand on elected officials to change what is occurring today. And without that public participation, without that engaged citizenry, it can't happen. That's why the minority of the population is determining the political system that we unfortunately are experiencing today. And that's what we have to change. If more people became involved, that could make a profound difference. And one way to get involved is to initiate these efforts within their states. Hopefully it can be done through the legislatures and governors, but if it can't, there are other alternatives in which they can pursue to make it happen.
Are there states that have independent commissions?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, my own state of Maine does. The number of commissioners, I think it's 7 and 7, equally divided between both parties, but they both have to agree on a neutral chair. The state of California developed several years ago a total citizens commission In other words, the political parties aren't involved. But that's another option, and that's worked exceptionally well in their state. And as a result, for example, candidates for the legislature, when they're running for office, they have to appeal to a broader segment of the population. They have to orient their appeal, their positions, their views to a broader audience than just the narrowly tailored one that's designed for one political party and the limited base of that political party, which is more hardline and ideological. That's what we need to move away from. And that's why this will enhance broader voter involvement, which ultimately can make the huge difference in terms of what happens in the U.S. House and in the United States Senate.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Senator Olympia Snowe, former Republican senator from the state of Maine and author of Fighting for Common Ground, How We Can Fix the Stalemate in Congress. Senator Snowe is currently a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, that's a policy group based here in Washington, where she chairs the Commission on Political Reform, which just issued a report entitled A Bipartisan Blueprint to Strengthen Our Democracy. I'm your host, Carol Castiel, and please note for our July 12th PCUSA, we will host Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. She will preview the U.S.-Africa Summit in early August, where dozens of African heads of state will descend on Washington to further the U.S.-Africa relationship. If you have a question you want us to pose to the Assistant Secretary, please email it to me as soon as possible at pcusa@voanews.com, and I will use your question on the show. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. And here's a shout out to loyal listener Ray Ondoro from Nairobi, Kenya. We'd like to hear more from our female listeners out there. So ladies, please send an email with your feedback or questions to pcusa@voanews.com. And now back to our guest, Senator Olympia Snowe. Well, Senator, I wanted to ask you a question about the role of money in politics, which exacerbates this political divide. A couple of years ago, there was the Citizens United case. The Supreme Court controversially interpreted freedom of speech to include spending money, and this interpretation increased the flow of money into election campaigns, undermining attempts at campaign finance reform meant to reduce the influence of money. Does this particular decision undermine or detract from the many good recommendations your report has issued?
Well, I think that there's no question what evolved out of Citizens United decision that was handed down by the Supreme Court has been devastating, in my view, in terms of unleashing millions more dollars in these federal campaigns, which has really changed the course in political campaigns because ultimately it created the super PACs where there's no accountability. And it's also just contributing significantly to the negativity, to the demonization of opposition, and to the politics of destruction. Unfortunately, it will take something short of a constitutional amendment, which obviously is a very arduous path to pursue. So as a result, we decided, number one, to look at accountability in terms of disclosure and requiring those independent groups that are contributing to these campaigns. We think that the donors to those organizations ought to be disclosed. Transparency is one form of accountability. In fact, that is something that the Supreme Court has encouraged. So that will be critically important. So if it's Citizens for Better America, we'll know who are those donors for Citizens for Better America and put some sunlight into this dimension that has transformed political campaigns in this country. So that's one issue. And then the other one, we created a national bipartisan commission to examine the whole sphere of campaign financing. And it really is going to require a good faith effort from both political parties, but it would be constructed and comprised with appointments by the president, by both sides, from citizens as well. So it would be broad-based and it would be fair and impartial, because I think we have to get to the heart of this matter with respect to the way campaigns are financed today. There's so much money invested in these campaigns, and secondly, too much time spent in raising money on the part of elected officials, frankly, and taking time away from the jobs they ought to be doing in the House and in the Senate.
Indeed, and I remember one of your recommendations was that we needed a five-day work week. Some members of Congress stay 4 days and then they go back to their home districts, and also more meetings between members of Congress and the president.
It all invites communication, first of all, between the legislative and the executive branches, between the president and Congress, which is happening almost rarely.
Do you think more so under President Obama?
Yes, it has been, actually. It's just, unfortunately, has been one of the consequences of, you know, the polarization and the partisanship. Perhaps an underestimation of the importance of that communication that has to occur between the president and members of Congress, and certainly with leadership on a bipartisan basis. I know from my experience and having served the better part of three decades in both the House and Senate, most certainly the president plays a pivotal role in those conversations, initiating them, trying to frame the discussion and the issues that should come before Congress and recognizing the differences. So we talk about having at least a couple of sessions a year where the president would meet with both chambers on a bipartisan basis. But secondly, to have regular leadership meetings between the president and the congressional leadership on a monthly basis. That type of communication and those types of meetings ought to be occurring because, frankly, if they had, I think that so many of these issues that we're facing today might have been mitigated and remedied, which obviously didn't happen, whether it was on the budget, whether it was on international affairs, what we're seeing with the emergence of Iraq. There's so many ways in which it could have averted and curtailed the kind of crises that we have experienced time and again.
And now, is that the onus is on the executive branch to initiate?
Well, it
meetings?
Certainly helps, and certainly congressional leadership can as well. But obviously, to have, you know, they can request a meeting with the president. But it seems to me that it should come from the president on a regular basis. I mean, certainly that occurred with other presidents. I well remember President Reagan having regular meetings with the leadership, and I was part of the WHIP organization, and I was down there frequently as well. But he did that on a bipartisan basis because he understood he had to work with the other side. And also, having that two-way communication builds up a relationship of trust and understanding, even if you don't agree. But it really does take down some of the barriers that might exist by virtue of the fact you're not communicating or you don't get to understand or know the other person and what they're thinking. So unfortunately, it's been a lost opportunity throughout these recent years, particularly a time when we're facing some monumental and tumultuous times.
Senator Snow, what is your multi-pronged strategy for attempting to implement the many reforms that your commission has suggested, because sometimes these types of reforms are hailed and praised by lawmakers and others, and then they're shelved. Do you have a strategy, a grassroots strategy, that you are planning to implement?
We definitely do. We have an outreach strategy that will be multi-pronged. When we announced and released our document that included our plan, that was really the first step in a very long process. We planned throughout the summer and the fall to work with university and colleges to hold joint forums. So many colleges and universities I know that I've addressed and want to be involved and to promote these recommendations, involve student leaders and the student bodies of these campuses to initiate a lot of these efforts and to create that network nationwide. Organizations across the country have expressed an interest in doing joint events to promote them and to support them as well. We'll be working with organizations within Washington, in addition to the fact that members of the commission have been meeting with members in the U.S. House of the United States Senate. In fact, more than 40 meetings have occurred. So that's going to be ongoing with the staffs as well, and with groups within Washington who understand that so many of their issues are held in abeyance because of this discord and this dysfunction that's overtaken our political system, where no decisions are being made, no legislation is being moved. And they understand that unless they address the discord, they're not going to be able to really grapple with the key policy issues that they're so passionate about. So we've got a multi-pronged effort that will also include going to Congress after the election and through the beginning of next year to get those rules changes that will make a profound difference in how Congress works internally, and to support those who want those changes. And I think that is the way in which we're going to ultimately succeed. But we're going to be relentless in implementing these recommendations. We don't intend for this report to collect dust sitting on a table.
There's a great deal of focus on foreign policy, as you know, at the moment. President Obama has seen his approval ratings decline as the public watches developments in Iraq, Syria, and Ukraine. Polls indicate that Americans are tired of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and are leery of U.S. military involvement overseas. But polls also show Americans want to see the United States remain a leader on the world stage. What do you see as the challenges the U.S. faces in seeking to remain a preeminent superpower while at the same time being careful about foreign military deployments?
Well, it's a very important question, and I think it gets to the heart of where we stand today with respect to the gridlock and the hyperpartisanship and the political environment in which we find ourselves, because so often the world does look to the United States and how we address our problems, that we've been viewed as a leader in terms of the way we make decisions on the issues that we tackle. And so it's regrettable, given the dimensions of the problems we're facing, particularly now in what's happening and unfolding in the Middle East, that we're not having those kind of conversations between Congress and the President and on a bipartisan basis to work through these issues and how we want to position the United States in response to these critical issues. I mean, I think that this is unfortunately one of the consequences of the failure for both sides to work together and for both branches of government, because we know that we have been viewed as a leader in the past in the way we address both domestic and international issues. And this is not consistent with who we are. So more than anything else, it's important, I think, for the leadership in Congress to understand that, for the President to understand that, and therefore it does compel them to be sitting down and talking to one another rather than just ignoring these critical issues and let them happen without having a position that's important and consistent with our security interests and our national goals.
Senator Olympia Snowe is a senior fellow at the Bipartisan Policy Center, where she co-chairs its Commission on Political Reform. Senator Snowe, thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski and Caitlin Espelita for booking our guest. Our engineer was Ted Schneider. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.